So, given that the title of this conference is Causation, New Prospects, I thought I would go with a really bold question and a possibly bold answer. And the bold question is this. It's whether we should continue to aim as metaphysicians for a hard distinction between possible causation, that is merely possible causes, and actual causation, that is an actual causal relation obtaining between an actual event, C and E. And I'm going to give some motivating examples that call into question the need for this distinction. So the primary goal of this talk is just to ask the question in a motivating way, and the secondary goal of this talk is to suggest an extremely bold answer that perhaps we shouldn't countenance this distinction or aim for it anymore as metaphysicians. So here's some background to kind of warm you up to this initially crazy-sounding idea. There are many problems for accounts of actual causation. There are problems of preemption and overdetermination for counterfactual accounts of causation. Very roughly speaking, the counterfactual account of causation says that C causes E. If had C not occurred, E would not have occurred. And there are well-known counterexamples to this that I'll get into in a few minutes. There is a problem of probability raising without causation for probability raising accounts of causation. So probability accounts hold that C causes E, roughly speaking, if C raises the probability of E. Finally, there's the problem of causation by omission for energy transfer accounts. So energy transfer accounts of causation hold roughly that C causes E if C transmits some sort of mark or conserved quantity to E. So all of these accounts face various problems and counterexamples, but I think that one way to frame these problems is attempting to distinguish between actual and possible causation. That is, an underlying unifying desideratum of these series is that we must distinguish between actual and possible causation. That's just a kind of dogma.
Sorry.
No problem. But why? Why adhere to this dogma? From what I can see, there are three reasons. I will list them now, and later I will try to give some arguments against them. The first, one might think, is intuition. You might think that intuition favors actual causation. But some motivating cases I'm going to give later, I think, speak against this intuition. I'm going to suggest that what we really care about is causal salience in our theorizing, in our moral theorizing, and as a tool of scientific prediction and explanation. Prediction and explanation. You might think that we really need to hold on to this actual possible causation distinction because actual causation plays the key role we need it to play in things like predicting what's going to happen or explaining what already did happen. I will also argue against that. Finally, one might hold this distinction between actual and possible causation because of an attachment to Biff causation. So famously, Ned Hall holds that there are these two general concepts of causation. One is productive, or Biff's, the idea being that C causes E, just if C kind of oops E or bumps it or transfers a quantity to it. And the other is dependence, and that roughly tracks our counterfactual concept. And I think that over-attachment to Biff causation might be driving this over-attachment to actual causation. Now, before I begin, I should note that there's been precedent in recent years for taking possible causation metaphysically seriously. And there are various ways to flesh that out. But certainly, there have been many responses to this problem of trying to distinguish between actual and possible causation. And in recent years, I actually see a move to blur the line between these things. So arguably, Lewis's influence account of counterfactuals, which holds that roughly actual events, C and E, C causes E, if there's a pattern of counterfactual covariation between a bunch of modally fragile alterations on C and a bunch of modally fragile alterations on E. Phil Dow's quasi-causation, which holds very roughly that possible causes are like kind of causal or quasi-causal or causally suggestive. There's something in between being causal and non-causal. Jonathan Schaffer's contrastivism, which holds that causation is a quaternary, that is, a four-place relation between an actual event C and an actual event E, and a contrast class, a C star and an E star, where C star and E star are merely possible events. So it's a four-place relation between an actual event, and a possible event, and a possible event. Causation is probability raising. Arguably takes possible causation seriously insofar as what it is for something to cause something else is simply for it to raise the probability of its happening. Some interventionist frameworks, depending on how you set the variables, do take possible causation seriously by setting default and deviant variables in certain ways. And some dispositional theories of causation certainly make use of modal notions in formulating their theories. So there's been this kind of move to take possible causation seriously. Here's my plan. I'm going to use two well-known sorts of cases, in particular the ones that I work on, redundant causation and causation by omission, to suggest that the line between actual and possible causation is not firm, or is not firm as we might think initially. And then, the more radical claim is that I'm going to suggest that if we do not rely on BIF or productive causation, then we as metaphysicians should refocus our project on causal salience, or merely possible causation, in addition to actual causation. So I'm not trying to do away with actual causation, I'm just trying to refocus our energies a little and motivate that claim.
Could you have the microphone.
Of course. Thank you. All right. So, here's the first sort of problem case. I'm going to give a bunch of special kinds of redundant causation. So, roughly speaking, there's a case of redundant causation when there are multiple causes sufficient to bring about an effect. There's a whole taxonomy of these kinds of cases normally. There's a case of overdetermination where multiple causes are individually sufficient to bring about an effect. In the canonical case, Billy and Susie each throw a rock at a window, and each rock is individually sufficient to shatter the window. In a case of preemption, there is one preempting cause and one preempted cause. So for example, Billy throws his rock at the window, it shatters the window, and Susie's rock flies through the space where the window used to be. There's a preempting and a preempted cause. And there are cases of joint causation, where there are multiple causes that are necessary to bring about an effect. So consider a case where the unfortunate owner of this window has now fortified it, and it takes two rocks to bring about the shattering. That's a case of joint causation. So that's a taxonomy of kind of normal cases of redundant causation. But here I'm going to give some very weird ones and show what I think it suggests about the relationship between actual and possible causation. So first case, this is a really fun case if you're not familiar with it, the Thirsty Traveler case. Billy and Susie are each assassins targeting Thirsty Traveler. Thirsty Traveler has a canteen full of water, not quite a canteen, but it does the job, that she needs to drink for her survival. In an attempt to kill Thirsty Traveler, Billy empties the canteen of water and fills it with poison and sneaks away like, ha ha, I've gotten away with it. But the other assassin, Susie, unaware of Billy's assassination attempt, sneaks up and drains the canteen because Susie thinks this canteen is full of water that will help victim's survival. Victim tries to drink water from her canteen, but the canteen is empty and she dies of thirst. Now, how do we understand the causal status of each assassin? Note that neither makes an actual causal contribution to the death. This is a very weird case, and I'll get into the details in a few minutes. But for now, the kind of salient question is, how do we understand the causal contributions of these merely possible causes? Second case, smart bullet. So suppose that Billy and Susie have grown up from their rock-throwing delinquent ways and have become full-grown assassins. And suppose that Billy has a normal bullet, while Susie has a satellite-guided smart bullet, poised to kill victim if Billy's bullet doesn't do the job. So suppose that Billy shoots the gun containing his normal bullet, and Susie shoots the gun containing her smart bullet. And remember, the properties of the smart bullet are that it just hovers next to the normal bullet, like maybe with a little helicopter drone sort of setup, just waiting to see if the other bullet does its job. Now suppose that Billy's normal bullet kills victim, whereas Susie's smart bullet merely hovers near victim at every point between her shooting it and victim's death. Had Billy's bullet not killed victim, Susie's bullet would have killed victim at exactly the same time. So note that the smart bullet never actually touches victim, but I think there's something causally creepy about it. We can ask, what is the causal status of the smart bullet? Next case, you might be familiar with this from the literature, trumping preemption. I am not going to use a magic case for those of you familiar with those, because I think they're a little weird, so I've just made up a new case. Suppose that it is a rule of a remote-controlled time lock safe that at midnight, it responds to the first lock command of the day. At 6 a.m., Billy commands the safe to lock. At noon, Susie commands the safe to lock. And at midnight, the safe locks. Now here we have a rule governing which process the safe is supposed to listen to, and yet each cause is attached to a full process and is individually sufficient to bring about the locking in the way that it occurs. So we can ask, what is the causal status of the trumped or preempted causal process? How do we understand it? Next, a case from the free will literature, a Frankfurt-style case. Suppose that Billy is an assassin and Susie is an evil neuroscientist. If Billy doesn't shoot and kill victim at time T, Susie's chip in Billy's brain will make him kill victim at time T. And suppose that now Billy shoots and kills victim of his own volition. So this kind of backup chip never had to do any work, but it was just sitting there hovering in the background. How do we understand the causal status of the remote-controlled chip? Final case, another fun case, colliding bullets. These are all a little unlikely, but they get the point across. So Billy and Susie each shoot at victim at the same time. Discharged alone, either bullet would have been sufficient to kill victim. But the bullets collide midstream and weaken their trajectory, such that both bullets are necessary for victim's death. Victim, let's suppose, dies from the wound. Now, how should we think about this case? Is this a case of joint causation, or is this a case of overdetermination? One might see it both ways, depending on how you read the case. Now, traditionally, with respect to these examples, theories of causation have been largely concerned with distinguishing between actual and possible causation. Like, that's the major reason for freaking out. Oh no, we can't distinguish between these possible and actual causes. Let's add all of the bells and whistles onto the theories. But I'm more concerned with two other questions. One is kind of a first order causal question, and the other is a methodological question. So the first order causal question is, just how do we understand the merely possible causal contributions in all of these cases? Like I said, I think in the past, we've basically just ignored the merely possible causal contributions in favor of trying to get a good account of the actual causal contribution. But I think what's interesting about these cases is that we don't want to ignore those merely possible causes. I think they play pretty heavy predictive roles. That is, we can predict what's going to happen based on the merely possible causes. Perhaps controversially, I think they play explanatory roles. We can help explain what happens in virtue of them. And they also play moral roles. So for example, I don't think we would just let Susie off the hook for shooting her smart bullet. We'd be like, oh, it's so lucky that smart bullet never hit victim. You know, just don't arrest Susie. Similarly with these other sorts of cases, clearly merely possible causes, or what I call causally salient causes, are playing some sort of metaphysically interesting role. So I'm interested in that question, first order. The methodological question I'm interested in is, why not focus more on possible causation? or what I call salient causes. Those seem to be of interest too, not just in helping us distinguish between possible and actual causation, but of independent interest, and I don't think they've been explored. So my treatment of these cases, as you might have guessed from the title, is something I call counterfactual causal overdetermination. It's been a dogma of most of the literature on causal overdetermination that overdetermination cases require multiple actual causal contributions sufficient to bring about an effect. But I think we can give a unifying explanation of all of the cases of redundant causation I just listed by calling them all counterfactual overdetermination. Roughly, C is a counterfactual overdeterminer of E if C is an actual event that is counterfactually sufficient to cause E in the way that it occurs. C is attached to some sort of complete causal process. I list some types of completion below. And E occurs. The motivation for this is that in most cases of overdetermination, we hold fixed the fact that E occurs. In the nearest possible world, where C1 doesn't cause E, C2 does cause E. Counterfactual overdetermination can be symmetric or asymmetric. Symmetric counterfactual overdetermination occurs when multiple causes are counterfactually sufficient for E's occurrence in exactly the way that it does occur. And I'll get into why that is in a minute. Asymmetric overdetermination occurs when at least one cause is actually sufficient for E's occurrence, and at least one other cause is merely counterfactually sufficient for E's occurrence in exactly the way that it does occur. The implication here, per the title, is that I think in these cases, we should count possible causes as causes, so we can give a unifying explanation of these weird redundant causation cases by holding that they're all cases of counterfactual overdetermination. Now, I'm not going to get into types of causal completion right now, but we can get into them in Q&A if you'd like. I think that types of causal completion have been kind of like run over in the literature. We normally just think of causal completion as a chain of spatiotemporally contiguous causal intermediaries between C and E. But in fact, I think the picture is much more complex. In particular, I think there's a kind of completion that's been ignored that I call dependent completion. There's a case of dependent completion when, at every moment along the main cause's causal trajectory, the second cause is kind of looking at the other one, as in the case of Smart Bullet, ready to jump in and bring about the effect should the first one not do it. So in other words, we can have merely counterfactual causal intermediaries as well as actual ones. So now we can revisit the problem cases of redundant causation with this new awesome tool in hand. Thirsty Traveler comes out as a case of symmetric counterfactual overdetermination. That is, each one is counterfactually sufficient to bring about the death of victim. Smart Bullet, that is the bullet that hovers near the other one at every time at which it's about to do its job, comes out as a case of asymmetric counterfactual overdetermination. We have one actual causal contribution and one counterfactual causal contribution. Trumping preemption, that is the safe case, similarly comes out as a case of asymmetric counterfactual overdetermination. Frankfurt case comes out as a case of asymmetric counterfactual overdetermination. And colliding bullets comes out as a case of symmetric counterfactual overdetermination, because counterfactually, each of the bullets would have been individually sufficient to bring about the death. So I think this is a kind of beautiful unifying explanation for all of these disparate sorts of redundant causation that have caused taxonomic problems in the past for metaphysicians of causation. So here are a few immediate objections and some replies. First objection, it seems that, according to my view, an event can be considered a cause of a merely possible effect. That is, an effect that doesn't happen at all. Here's an example, assassin failure. Billy and Susie each shoot at victim at the same time. Discharged alone, either bullet would have been sufficient to kill victim, but the bullets collide midstream and weaken their trajectory such that neither bullet hits victim. Lucky victim. victim survives. I think there are two ways to go with this kind of objection. My first response is that I think in most cases of causal overdetermination, E's occurrence is held fixed. If E doesn't occur, C1 and C2 aren't causes of it. But the second, more interesting and suggestive way to go is that if we take merely possible causes metaphysically seriously, we should also take merely possible effects seriously. And note that just to pump your moral intuitions a little, it doesn't seem like Billy and Susie would go unpunished, even if their bullets collide and never hit victim. They would be arrested for some sort of attempted murder or something like that. Another objection is that there are cases in which the causes are modally connected. That is, there's a modal relationship between C1 and C2, as in the famous case of causal overdetermination involving a mental property and its subvening physical property. In these cases, the objection goes, we can't hold fixed the fact that E occurs if we remove one of the redundant causes, because in the nearest possible world where we remove one, we also have to remove the other. I completely admit that that's true. Not all cases of overdetermination should involve holding E's occurrence fixed. In particular, there are these weird cases where there's like a relationship of necessity between C1 and C2. Clearly, this account doesn't apply to those. Another objection might be that arguing for the existence of counterfactual overdetermination, at least as a category, is a merely verbal move that simply renames the problem cases without changing the metaphysics of causation. But as you might see from the title and the motivation of this talk, I think that counterfactual overdetermination cases and cases of causation by omission that I'll get into in a minute provide theoretical support for according some sort of causal status to merely possible causes. That is, I kind of bite the bullet here and say, no, I think what these cases really show is that there is some sort of causal status going on with these merely possible causes. So it's not merely verbal. That is, we're not just disagreeing on terminology. I actually think these are causes, crazy as that sounds. Now, the second sort of well-known case, after cases of redundant causation, are cases of omissive causation and causation of preventions. So in the first famous case, I just call plant, not very creative, I promise to water your plant while you are out of town, fail to water the plant, and the plant dies. Intuitively, my failing to water the plant caused the plant to die. So it seems like here we definitely have absence causation, and there's a question of what it is. Second case, attack prevention. Police stop the explosive-filled truck from reaching its destination, thus causing the absence of the terrorist attack. Yay, police. So there's this independent question, what are omissions? My treatment in my 2013 paper is that omissions are possibilities. An omission is an event such that had it occurred, the outcome would not have occurred. I'm not going to repeat all of the reasoning for that here, but here are just a few motivating claims for it. The first is that omissions can't be actual things. So I think that the initial temptation is to identify an omission, say my failing to water the plant, with whatever I could have been doing in its place, say checking Facebook or speaking at an amazing conference in Paris, for example. But those don't generate true counterfactuals. For example, it's not necessarily true that had I not checked Facebook, the plant wouldn't have died. Second, there's a really acute problem of multiple realizability. That is, omissions are flexibly realized. We don't want to reduce the omission to my checking Facebook because there are many activities that I could have been doing in the place of watering the plant. Omissions are multiply realizable with respect to space, time, and activity. So we can't just reduce the omission to one space, time, and activity. There are just like too many possibilities in the subvenient space. I also don't think that omissions are non-things. There are many ways you can see omissions as non-things. I think it's relatively obvious that omissions are not like gaping black holes in reality, right? It's not because as if I'm failing to sing karaoke right now, which is lucky for all of us, there's a big smoky black hole where I am. Rather, It seems like the best way to conceptualize omissions is as possible things. And we already seem to conceptualize them in this manner. For example, when I fail to water the plant or when I'm failing to sing karaoke, we naturally seem to identify the possible world where I do water the plant or where I do sing karaoke. So my treatment of these cases is that omissions identify things at possible worlds. Conceptually and metaphysically, omissions, which include prevented effects as well, I think must be possible things if we admit them. Now, the interesting thing here is that in cases of causation by omission and prevention, possible events straightforwardly play the same predictive, explanatory, and moral roles of actual events. And Dow holds this in his quasi-causation view, but I think it's intuitive here that if we want to hold that omissions are causal, then we have to hold that they're possibilities, and thus we have to hold that possible causes can be causes in some metaphysically interesting sense. So, time for the bigger picture. I think we can pause and ask, is there a good reason to accept a hard distinction between actual and possible causation? This is a dogma that's been floating around for a long time. I suggested at the beginning that putative reason number one, intuition privileges actual causation. So it seems like when we talk about causation a lot, it might seem like we're only talking about actual causation. But I actually disagree that intuition privileges actual causation. Rather, I think intuition favors a continuum of possible and actual causation, not a hard distinction between them. So return to the normal preemption case, where, say, Billy shoots victim and Susie's bullet flies through the space where the window used, or where the window, where victim used to be. Victim is now lying on the ground. There's certainly something interesting about the preempted process. I don't think that we should ignore it or simply focus on trying to distinguish between actual and possible causes. Rather, I think that in our everyday causal theorizing, we take that merely possible cause to be salient in a predictive way, in an explanatory way, and in a moral way. Second reason you might think we need this hard distinction between actual and possible causation, you might think we need actual causation due to its role in prediction and in scientific explanation. But I think that possible causes largely play the same predictive and explanatory roles. In fact, many scientists don't countenance a distinction between actual and possible causation. And note that many more scientific notions of causation, the causal relation, just care about manipulability and interventions. They don't actually care what the causal relation is, just that something can be caused in a certain way. Putative reason number three, BIF causation, or a kind of productive relationship, only tracks actual causation. So if causation just is a transfer of quantity from C to E, then it doesn't seem like merely possible things can do that. So my reply to that is an overall skepticism about BIF causation. First, I don't think BIF causation is sufficient to capture most causal judgments. And here we can refer back to Ned Hall's two concepts of causation, where he is skeptical about the same thing. I actually extend that one step further. I'm not sure that BIF causation is actually doing any work in our causal judgments. I think that even our BIF intuitions are difference-making or counterfactual in nature. And in fact, they can be captured entirely in terms of difference-making and counterfactuals. We don't actually need the transfer of conserved quantity stuff at all. So those are three reasons you might want to hold fast to this actual causation, but I don't think those are great reasons. Now for some more general objections and replies to be extended, obviously, in the Q&A period. So you might object that I have just gone crazy, the jet lag is getting to me. Clearly, possible causes cannot be causes. Why would one even hold this? But I think that's exactly the dogma that we should question. unless there's an antecedent commitment and an independent argument for it, that a productive theory of causation is the right one and the exclusively right one, I don't think there's any reason to relegate possible causes to a lesser causal status than actual causes. Rather, and I'll get into this in a minute, I think that what we care about is causal salience in general, where causal salience includes possible causation as well as actual causation. The second response is that we can still conceptually distinguish between actual and possible causation. I'm certainly not trying to do away with the conceptual distinction between them. Rather, I'm trying to refocus the energy from the goal of distinguishing between them to seeing them on a continuum and caring more about possible causation in addition to actual causation. That is, we don't have to hold anymore that they each fall on some sort of line of a hard metaphysical distinction. You might think that a problem for this view, an insurmountable one at that, is profligate possible causation. That is, you might wonder how we can distinguish between salient possible causes and non-salient ones. That would seem to be insurmountable at first, and certainly would be a crazy view to hold, probably a reductio of that view, if all of the possible causes were the causes. I mean, that would be a really cool view to hold. I don't want to hold that view, and I don't think anyone else would want to hold it either. But note that theories of causation, in one way or another, already face this problem and similar problems of salience, even when they're just focused on actual causation. Any account of causation by omission suffers from profligate omissive causation. That is, the idea that if we accept any omissions as causes, we have to accept all of the omissions as causes. For example, returning to the case where I promised to water your plant, I fail to water it and the plant dies. The counterfactual, if I hadn't failed to water your plant, the plant wouldn't have died, is true. But the counterfactual, if Barack Obama hadn't failed to water your plant, the plant wouldn't have died, is also true. So any theory, almost any theory, I should say, which countenances profligate, or which countenances causation by omission, will have to deal with this in any case. Next, counterfactual accounts of causation need a semantic framework and a similarity metric for possible worlds. Those projects are largely concerned with salience already and have had kind of, you know, trouble accounting for various salience relations. Interventionist theories of causation need an account of which variables count as default and which variables count as deviant. That itself is a problem of salience. Dispositional accounts of causation need an account of closeness of worlds. Sufficiency accounts of causation need a distinction between background conditions and causes. And contrastive accounts of causation, like Jonathan Schaffer's, need rules for the appropriate contrast classes. Now, this is not to make you all depressed about the prospects for a good theory of causation. Rather, it's to note that finding salient possible causes is no more insurmountable than finding salient actual causes, I think, given the resources of our current theories. That is, we're already struggling with these problems with actual causation. I don't think it's much more insurmountable than trying to find salient possible causes as well. One might also think that for causation theorists, giving up on distinction between actual and possible causation is giving up entirely. But I don't think it's giving up. It's like the pep talk time. Rather, I think it's redirecting our philosophical energies from accounting for intuitions that, in fact, I think are unstable about actual causation to focusing on what it is to be causally salient. And in a sense, we're already trying to do this, as I noted above, with our theories of actual causation. Salience, rather than mere actual causation, plays the central role in our causal theorizing. We clearly care about possible causes as well as actual causes already. Note also that many theories of causation are revisionary rather than descriptive. They might not like to call themselves that, but I certainly think that's true. For example, theories that accept transitivity are trying to revise our causal concepts. So I place the bomb under Jim's desk. Jim finds the bomb, thus causing his survival. By transitivity, my placing the bomb under his desk causes his survival. Many people think that we have to accept that. Also, theories would accept my birth caused my death as true, because had my birth not occurred, my death would not have occurred. In a sense, causal theories are already revisionary, even though they don't think they are. So, to conclude, as causation theorists, I think we should focus on cordoning off salient causes, actual and possible, rather than on theories of actual causation. I think this revised goal reflects the role of possible causation in our reasoning and makes use of the work on salience that our theories must do in any case. Thank you.